Welcome to the F3, Female Forward Finance. I'm your host, Jill Faraday Lloyd, a financial advisor at UBS Private Wealth, and I'm on a mission to help women have agency with their capital. The F3 is a space for real conversations about money, power, and everything in between. You'll hear from experts, entrepreneurs, and everyday Janes about the choices they're making when it comes to their wealth. These are critical conversations because women are earning, building, and shaping what comes next in the world, and it's time we own every bit of our power. On this week's F3, I sit down with Stephanie Kirkpatrick, founder of financial payments company Aurum, which was recently sold to Stripe. Stephanie is a certified financial planner, and she shares practical strategies for maximizing personal wealth, including key planning moves founders often overlook. We discuss how early fundraising decisions and understanding acquirers could shape the outcome of your business exit. She also offers advice on building a support network, planning for what's next, and aligning your entrepreneurial journey with your personal values. I'm telling you, Stephanie's journey is a masterclass in strategic growth and authentic leadership. This is essential listening for any founder ready to turn vision into a successful legacy. Let's dive in. I'm thrilled to welcome Stephanie Kirkpatrick, the indomitable founder of Aurum, which was just acquired by Stripe. Stephanie is a fintech founder, operator, and product leader, passionate about building the infrastructure that powers smarter, faster financial decisions. A certified financial planner and the daughter of an immigrant, she spent two decades reimagining how money moves and works for everyone, from building financial planning tools at LearnVest and Northwestern Mutual to pioneering real-time payments as founder and CEO of Aurum.io. Today, at Stripe, she continues that mission by helping scale the financial infrastructure that powers the internet. Welcome, Stephanie.
Jill, thank you so much for having me. It's great to be here today.
It's wonderful to have you, and it's so cute to see you all bundled up with your hat and your coat in
the
studio.
It's cold in the studio today.
It's very cold. We're all shaking in here. Today, we're going to be diving into the journey of building, scaling, and selling a business, with a special focus on the unique levers female founders can pull to maximize value. And before we dive in, I just want to revisit this notion of the three-legged stool, which I revisit all the time. When you are thinking about the sale of your business, if you're growing a business to sell it, you need to focus on three things. And if it's a stool with three legs, you have to focus on all three. The first is you need to maximize the saleable value of your business. The second is you need to maximize your personal financial wealth. And the third is you have to have a plan for your what's next. And it's so exciting to have you here because you've been through this. You've been to this rodeo before, right?
I have indeed.
Give us a little background on the previous companies that you were engaged with from beginning to sale.
Well, I like to say in some ways my career doesn't make a lot of sense because it detours around in various parts of financial services. But I started my career as a financial planner. And I was very fortunate to join a New York-based startup called LearnVest, where we were building financial advice for the 99%. And while building out that business, we had a very unique opportunity to join ranks and get acquired by Northwestern Mutual, which is a large insurance company. For those that are out there listening, you probably own life insurance from Northwestern Mutual and maybe don't even realize it. And so I was very quickly introduced to a version of an acquisition that looks like transformation, right? A small, young, hungry startup changing the dynamics of the way advice is given and received so that everyday Americans can actually access the same types of tools that the wealthy access was always such a big mission. And to join ranks with a huge organization was both empowering but also incredibly challenging. You have to marry together different technologies. You have to marry together different frameworks for how the business runs. And so I often say in those years of post-merger life at Northwestern Mutual, I was going to Harvard, right? I was getting that like firsthand case study work that you often read about. And from the perspective of successful outcomes, I can genuinely say it's one of the most interesting things I've ever gotten to work on.
I mean, it must have been. And then also to go from the fast pace of a tech startup to an insurance company. What was that like?
Well, it definitely had its learnings. But I think one of the things that really gave me an appreciation for, which is what ultimately led me to be interested in financial infrastructure, which is where Aurum comes in later, is to understand the magnitude of technical investment that has gone into building a business of that scale, right? The amount of insurance issued, the type of underwriting, the claims and policy management paid out over decades and decades and decades is both sophisticated but also antiquated. And so sitting at the intersection of a modern moment where people have realized in the last decade or two that financial advice is actually something they want to have, and helping Northwestern Mutual get to a place where their tooling was able to meet the needs of the market from a financial advice perspective was exhilarating, but I learned a lot about what goes on inside the underbelly of financial services. And one of the challenges we faced at Northwestern Mutual that I think most industries face is that money in, out, and across the business is not as seamless as a customer would think. And so I very much gained both knowledge and education, but also inspiration for how I would shape what I would build next in Aurum and the way I would think about instant money movement and financial infrastructure as a further unlock for financial access overall.
Well, you seem to have done it quite well, given that you were just acquired by Stripe.
We are certainly experiencing a lot of change this year in my life. Joining Stripe this summer was an exciting outcome for Aurum and something that I'm really proud of, because when you found a company, you often wonder, will anyone else ever see the vision that I see? Will the world meet me where I'm at and where I'm going?
I love that.
Yeah.
I love that.
Yeah.
So what is it like during that period where you're wondering, is the world going to get me? What are some of the things that you tell yourself each day when you get up and you're like, I'm creating this thing. When is somebody going to understand?
Well, you know, when I started Aurum in 2019, the U.S. was starting to spend more time on faster payments. And I was really interested in that, coming from an immigrant household, seeing what it was like to have my dad go through life without the financial benefits and infrastructure that, you know, most Americans benefit from, and seeing him run a small business where, you know, time to money was a really legitimate problem in our family and for his business, inspired me to be personally really convicted that if the U.S. could figure out faster payments, we could unlock massive benefits for small business owners and for consumers, and actually for large enterprises as well. So in 2019, the Clearinghouse was building RTP, our first faster payment system here in the U.S. And the concept, I think, was started for FedNow, but it hadn't been built yet. And my insight was that if we were going to have faster payment mechanisms, and the only way that you could buy them was to go to a bank, we were going to have a distribution problem. Mm-hmm. So my vision that money movement should feel like Amazon same-day delivery was always something I could really express, but helping people appreciate that they needed alternative technologies to get to these faster payments was definitely, in some moments, a big uphill battle. People thought, well, the banks are already going to master it. Well, we'll have every bank on faster payments before the end of the year, right? So in those times, I faced a lot of contrarian views. And I always came back to one thing, which is if it didn't take 3 to 5 to 7 days for money to clear and settle, money that you own that might be in your high yield savings, but you want to get it over to your investment account, or it's in your investment account and you need to pay a bill with it, imagine what would look different. And the benefits of money moving instantly are incredibly powerful to the fabric of the American economy. And I know that having been a financial planner, I've seen thousands and thousands of households struggle with the basic concept of being willing to part with some portion of their money to save or invest it because they can't get it back at night, on holidays, or on the weekends. Mm-hmm. And so I just knew in my heart that faster payments had a place in this world and that I really wanted to spend time mastering infrastructure. It wasn't always easy. In fact, it was oftentimes quite hard.
Oh, I can imagine. So you had an understanding of where there was a pain point. You understood
how the system works. You understood what was guiding individuals as mm-hmm. a CFP, mm-hmm. right? And putting that all together to build Aurum was an incredible journey, I can imagine. I'd like to ask you if, you know, now that you've worked at a couple of startups that have exited, what are some of the levers that you think that female founders should be thinking about to maximize the saleable value of their businesses?
I love this question because oftentimes, in fact, I spoke to a female founder last night and she was asking me some questions about a potential exit. And I think for a lot of folks, you entertain those questions when the opportunity comes up for somebody to be interested in potentially acquiring your company, which in my view is a little bit later than when you ideally want to start having the planning mapped out. So maximizing value of your company actually starts with the fundraising decision. And I'll unpack that. What I mean is that, first of all, there are lots of ways to fund a business. Venture capital is one of them. That is the path I have been on. It is not the only path. But if you think about what venture capital provides, it is essentially a mechanism for splitting up the value of the company among you and your investors with the hopes that as you progress in growing your customer base and your revenues and your moat and your differentiation, there will be an exit path, perhaps acquisition, perhaps other options, that provides an ROI on those first dollars in. And what I think sometimes gets overlooked is that each and every round of capital that you raise puts a higher and higher benchmark on what you need to achieve in order for an exit to work well for your investors and ultimately to work well for you and your employees, which is something I think founders care deeply about, but sometimes don't understand as intimately when the hype cycle of raising capital is what they hear about, right? We see headline after headline and TechCrunch and all of the different publications about fundraising rounds. And so I think that can be misleading from the perspective of understanding what the trade-offs are each and every time you bring capital in the door.
Sure. You have a higher hurdle and you dilute yourself and your employees.
Absolutely.
Right?
Absolutely.
Let's talk about the different types of acquirers. Mm. So you talked about Northwestern Mutual and you're now, you know, you just sold to Stripe. Very, very different. How do you as a founder, as an acquired company, think about who you want to go to for these types of when you want to sell your business?
Well, hopefully founders have choice in the matter. Sometimes they do, sometimes they don't. But depending on the industry you're in, and the industry I've been in is payments or financial services, you're often looking at a mix of strategics who are established incumbents in the space, much like Northwestern Mutual was. Or in payments, maybe a bank or a payment processor. And then you're sometimes seeing bigger versions of yourself in the market. So in this case, Stripe as a big payments company, as a very tech-forward growth company. And each one of those scenarios presents differences in what role you might play as a founder in the future, post-acquisition, what the job to be done is. And I would say, thinking about Northwestern Mutual for a second, part of the job to be done was to create a talent magnet and to help Northwestern Mutual establish a presence in New York City so they could hire high-caliber engineering talent for their future. Things like that are not always talked about, but can be deeply important and big value drivers when it comes to thinking about the value of the business above and beyond what might just be, you know, pure ROI calculations on revenue.
And when you're thinking about selling your business to a big company that's, you know, in the financial services broadly and not necessarily a larger version of yourself, mm-hmm. what did you think about or what should the founders think about in terms of their earnouts?
Great question.
And how long they want to stick around?
Yes. Well, it's interesting. I think that, and this is maybe a bit of a contrarian take, that the thesis that there is an earnout and you must stay 3 years and you are handcuffed to something is not exactly a positive sentiment, right? And so I do think that a lot of times founders are evaluating how long do I, air quotes, have to stay versus making an assessment of what can I gain in the time I'm going to commit to being at this company. And in the more strategic space, incumbent financial services, Integrations are not easy. They're not fast. The one we did at Northwestern Mutual took years. Mm. And so understanding what you're signing up for and trying to do as much diligence on the acquirer and where they're at technically is important because they're in sales mode. They want to acquire you. You also want to understand this is a two-sided contract. It's a two-sided relationship. To the best of your abilities in moments like that, understanding their tech stack, their pain points, the investment areas, their growth levers, how you fit into that, both individually, how your team fits and where your customers and your technology fit are all important components of evaluating, is this for me? And the truth is, I think deals can be structured in so many different ways that there isn't going to be one formula. But for a founder to be able to get excited about getting out of bed every day, hopefully it's for more than the dollars that are in the transaction. And potentially it's to see the opportunity to be transformative in a bigger organization, to bring new thinking in a place that hasn't had it yet, or to bring a customer profile that doesn't exist yet for that financial service or organization is really exciting. And I think can be one of the things that helps folks get past the idea that they are locked in and start to think about it as years of accumulated learnings.
Right. Yeah, and we also talked about this notion of having a business model mm-hmm. that attracts the right buyer, the type of buyer where you'd like to work afterwards.
Yes, indeed. Yeah, I think you are always on this journey as a founder to figure out how to build the right base of revenue, which is part of what adds value to the business. But some of the externalities that go with that is potentially what you spend time on as a founder, cultivating a network, building a brand personally and for your startup. Those things, I think, play into then what it feels like when you land in an organization that's new to you and that can take advantage of more than just maybe the product experience you have or the revenue base that you're bringing in. And sometimes in financial services, the ability to marry a software component or a SaaS model with existing distribution of financial products is a win-win. So I don't think that there is unilaterally one profile that will make sense for strategic acquisition. But understanding how your revenue model fits into the acquirers is going to be important when you're thinking about what makes for a great acquisition.
Absolutely. All right. So I'd like to shift, if we can, and talk a little bit about personal wealth. Okay. And I love that you have a CFP, right? And what did you know that most other founders don't know about how to prepare for your maximizing your personal wealth at the end of the day?
Well, 16 years ago, I was taking my CFP education classes and getting ready to take my exam. I know this because I just did my CE credits about a week ago. And so I looked and I was like, oh, 16 years. Wow, it's been a while. And I remember when I was getting the certification, I would call my mom on my way home from class and be like, guess what I learned today? And I feel like back then I didn't have very much life experience. And so getting my CFP taught me so much about the financial opportunities that exist that maybe some individuals discover eventually, maybe they don't. And so as a financial planner, I feel so fortunate that I have the personal experience lived through my education and through my work experience practicing prior to being a founder at Aurum to think through what I should do at the beginning of starting a company. So a couple of those things include, first and foremost, understanding QSBS. It's something that I have been surprised to learn some founders don't know about. And they start companies and they get incorporated and lawyers don't tell them about it and nobody tells them. And then they've missed the chance to benefit from it. So it's a special tax carve out for a portion of the qualified stock you own. And the rules actually just changed to be more favorable to have a less, let's say, enduring hold period for at least a portion of the stock. And in short, it lets you walk away with some of your earnout tax free. Mm-hmm. And I think many Americans are thinking about how do I gain wealth and diminish taxes? Just simple math. So knowing about and understanding and planning for QSBS, filing your 83B election, yes, you have to go to the post office and you have to get all kinds of little proof points that you've filed said letter. But that could be worth tens
selfies.
Of millions of dollars, right? Yes, I took lots of pictures of this and I did it. Number one, just understanding that. I think number two is thinking about how to stack QSBS, also not well understood. Mm-hmm. So sitting down with an estate attorney and a financial advisor, ideally up front, is a good first step, because folks that specialize in planning for founders are well educated in how you can leverage trusts. And in this case, I did this for my children, to distribute stock in the beginning at a low basis that can then qualify multiple times for the QSBS exemption. So those were just like first principles things that...
And just for our listeners to know that the reason that you're doing that is to move those shares off your balance sheet.
Yes.
So that when you pass, your children are not paying estate taxes on everything above your exemption amount.
Well, and also, in addition to that, in the actual recognition of gain on the qualified small business stock, you have your portion that belongs to you, and the portion that belongs inside of the trusts is also eligible for the tax exemption.
Right.
And the trust we established are not necessarily ones that have to be used after I'm no longer here. So it allows us to do things like education and other investments for the kids ahead of their age of maturity. So lots of ways to construct these.
Correct.
Which is why I highly recommend financial advisor in your back pocket from day zero. Now, I know that's challenging because financial advisors, and Jill, we've talked about this, also want to be able to help you manage wealth. And if you don't have it yet, there's always a conversation to be had. But I think just getting educated is one of the most important first steps.
Yeah. And I'll put a shout out at the end to offer up some resources around that for early stage startup founders. Okay, so that's step one, QSBS stacking. What else would you recommend?
You know, coming back to the fundraising question, I recommend understanding the economics of a sale to the best of your ability, and understanding that the way that a pref stack works, right, which is the waterfall of payback to your preferred shareholders, is something that I realize it's a word that gets thrown around, but the internalization of what it means is not always well understood. So one thing you can do here is have the lawyers who are putting together your financing help you see a distribution waterfall that explains the math, so that you know that if you sell the company for $25 million or $50 million or $100 million, what each of those triggers in terms of who gets paid first. And every round of financing potentially changes the way the preference stack works. So being mindful that you aren't just making a decision to partner with a new lead investor, but you may also be giving up some of your rights, and knowing better at the beginning before you start negotiations with those investors, I think is a powerful thing that many founders ultimately don't know about when they're negotiating, and they realize at the time of sale they wish they had made different choices. Both about who they bring on the cap table, how much they put on the cap table, and how the preference stack payout works. Because as a founder, you're typically a common shareholder.
Yeah.
And generally speaking, common shareholders get paid back after preferred shareholders.
Correct.
And that's something that just, I think, I find people are surprised by that when they're actually in the moment.
Hmm. What about compensation? How do we want to, what do you recommend?
I also have a view on this just formed from the time that I've spent as a founder. And I think that the venture capital ecosystem has come closer and closer to this reality, which is a founder should take a paycheck. Now, how much paycheck, I think, is relative to the stage of the business. And I think it's okay to take a larger paycheck when revenues are higher than when you start. But sometimes the concept of venture capital and the idea that you should be a starving founder, one, I think, is exclusionary, because adults of a certain age with a certain, you know, profile of, let's say, kids and a mortgage might not be able to just, air quotes, eat ramen and live in the office all day. So there's some realities that I think would push people away from founder life if we were to always say it has to be that way. And two, I think it does create a financial stressor. Anyone who's ever been behind on bills, who's ever been underwater financially, who's ever not had enough month to month, anyone who's ever experienced that will tell you, in those times, you make less good choices for your future because you're solving for the short term. And if you endure 5 to 10 years of little to no wages with the hope that there's upside, I think two things happen. One is you can be very, very disappointed later if there isn't upside. Sometimes it doesn't work out and you don't get a payday. But more importantly, I think sometimes founders look to the first offer they get and they want to take the offer for acquisition because they feel like they've been poor for a number of years and a few million dollars in their pocket would make them feel better. And I think those are the wrong reasons to sell your company, ultimately. So just starting with first principles that you too are an employee of the company. You might be the founder. You have a very different kind of job than the other employees. But being able to take a paycheck is, I think, something we should normalize. And I do see that there's more trend lines towards normalizing
that. I love hearing you say that. Because there's oftentimes conversations with founders who don't really understand what their number is. What do they need to clear on an after-tax basis to live that dream that they've been working and eating ramen for the last 10 years? And there are so many different elements that affect that, from your ability to understand the waterfalls to set up QSBS stock, right? It all starts really at the beginning.
It does. And sometimes I think because founders are so impassioned about what they're building, and because as a population, we do lack critical financial literacy education, sometimes people are unaware that, you know, the decisions they're about to make are going to be very damaging later. An example of that might be taking a second mortgage and not knowing that you're going to certainly be able to pay that mortgage back. It might mean somebody cashes out their 401k because they think they have a big payday for their startup and they never do. And then not only did they cash out what they did save, perhaps in those years they weren't saving at all. And now time has passed that you can't get back, and compounding interest is the most powerful thing we have, right?
Amen. Yep. Well, I'm so excited for you and these opportunities that you've created for yourself and your family through your smart planning. I know you still have time with Stripe. You only just got acquired. I'm sure there's very exciting things happening there. I'm sure you're going to be a very big part of their future. But I always like to ask folks about what their what's next is, right? And I know it might be early for you, but what are some of the things that you think are meaningful to you? So when I meet a client, we do a deep dive discovery. And the first question we ask is, what's important about money to you? And the reason we ask that question is to understand their values.
Absolutely.
And so why somebody starts a business, there's a value behind it. Why somebody grows it to a certain size, there's values behind that. They're always running in the background. So there's a statistic from the Exit Institute that said 70% of entrepreneurs regret selling their business within the first year because they didn't have something else to do. And so that's the third leg of the stool, is being really clear on what the purpose of your value, your money is, and what you want to do with it afterwards. And it could be, I'm ready to start my, you know, next company, or it could be whatever. How do you think about that? And is there anything on the horizon for us to hear about?
Well, I think starting with values, I'm very aligned with how you think about planning, which is that values are, you know, kind of the foundation of why have money in the first place and what are you prioritizing? And in my life, you know, we prioritize a couple of things, philanthropy being one of them, and specifically food insecurity. So part of my what's next is just continuing to spend time in my community and specifically with Feeding Westchester to be active both with my time and my dollars on a problem that has never been more important, but especially with our government shutdown, has really highlighted where there are gaps in the system. And I think food insecurity is something I understand very personally from being raised by somebody who came to America with nothing and was food insecure for most of his life. So that's one thing. I have a couple of other passion areas. And one of them, as Jill, you and I have talked about, is literacy generally and just reading as a passion. The statistics show that families and adults are not reading like we used to. Thank you for our smartphones, and thank you to Netflix for all of our great always-on content. There are so many other ways to keep our brains busy. And yet, I think that reading is one of the most powerful tools because it takes you away to another universe. You get to imagine and dream and believe. And I watch my kids, who are both good readers, develop an incredible vocabulary, all of which I think comes from the books that they steep themselves in. So I've been kicking around an idea, not baked yet, that I might want to fund a nonprofit mobile library for my community. Ideally, I'd like to pair that with the food insecurity theme and find a way to be able to bring food and literacy into various communities. And so I'm starting to think about not necessarily not having a full-time job. I love actually going to work and being challenged, but also having more purpose and more passion projects that I can invest in today.
Well, who knows who's listening? There may be some opportunities that come your way.
Indeed.
All right. I just want to direct this to all those founders who are in the messy middle of building their businesses. Not new, not ready to sell, but somewhere in between. Any advice for those founders?
Lots of advice. The messy middle is a place everyone goes to and everyone comes out of. Now, how they come out of it varies. But the messy middle is about starting to grow, I think, as a person, to figure out how you take a business that's got green shoots, that is growing, that is working, and start to turn on a catalyst for the next inflection point, whether that's a new product you launch, whether that's an extension of how you distribute your current products, whether it's how you lead the company. I think there are many things that start to happen when you're not at conclusion that you want to sell the company, but you start to see how this might play out over 2 or 3 or 5 more years. And you have to start mapping, as you said, Jill, a bit of a plan. Where do you end up? What are you hoping for? And are you spending time on things that are going to yield that result? So one of the things I love to tell founders at this stage is, if you aren't working with a startup coach, find one. And the reason I say that is because startups go through, and founders, therefore, very similar cycles. Finding product market fit, hiring your first actual executives, booking your first enterprise customer if you're in B2B, right? Cresting 80 to 100 people and suddenly realizing that the organization you were once running isn't what it was when it started. I mean, all of these challenges are ones that I think every founder faces. And it's a lonely place, particularly because you don't know always who you can trust. And so you might meet other founders and wonder, hey, are they going through the same thing? Their LinkedIn sure looks good to me, right? Social media has that way of making us feel like everything's perfect for everyone else. And the reality is, if you talk to founders that are willing to be open, they're all going to tell you, I've been there, I made that mistake, I fumbled the ball, I dropped this, I broke something, I had a setback, and here's the way I got through it. And the more we can share those stories, I think the more we empower people to push through and really grow in a moment in which they might have self-doubt or imposter syndrome or bad market conditions, which they don't control.
No, you can only
but you have to get through that.
That's right. Yeah. So what I hear you say, and when we spoke earlier, it's really around building that scaffolding, building your team. So who else is on your team besides the startup coach? Who do you need?
The other thing that I love to reference is a 911 list. So I often run into problems that I've never seen before as a founder. And I can, of course, call my board members and my investors. But sometimes I need like domain expertise, how to build the next sales incentive plan as we move into a new part of the market, what to do in, you know, dealing with a contract for an enterprise customer that I've never had to consult on before, dealing with the transformation to AI and whether or not we should or shouldn't be using certain tools. I mean, the questions are innumerable. And so if you develop a 911 list of people who will answer the phone if you text them and call them, and they will spare 15 minutes of their expertise, you can cut days to weeks off of the cycle of trying to figure out how to do something. And asking for help is just such a powerful tool. Put it in your toolbox. Everyone asks for help. The more senior people you meet in your life, the more you will realize, one, they're well-networked.
And they didn't get there alone.
They didn't get there alone, and they're always willing to lend a hand or extend a new introduction to someone that can actually help you with the problem you're facing.
That's wonderful advice. That's really wonderful advice, is phone a friend.
Phone a friend, that's
absolutely
right.
Absolutely. Any other insights you might have around how you should be taking care of yourself as you think about an exit?
I think just taking care of yourself, literally your physical and emotional and mental well-being, is often an afterthought at all stages, not just when you're thinking about an exit. But what's challenging about the exit moment is that you are running your company as if there is no acquirer and you have to make everything work. And you are running a process with hopefully multiple interested parties who might want to acquire your company. And you have to do both in a way that, one, is usually very highly confidential. And two, you have to be able to be present for your team without them knowing what you're up to in navigating this whole other part of the potential outcome for the company. I think it's extremely hard to take care of yourself. But the best things I recommend is, like, sign off and get some sleep. Don't say yes to every fintech happy hour and every dinner and every conference. Be very judicious. Will this move the needle for the business I'm building today? Are my customers going to be in the room? If not, don't go.
ROI on your time.
Absolutely. It's the most valuable thing you have.
Yeah. Amazing. Thank you so much, Stephanie, for sharing your insights. If listeners want to learn more about you or Aurum, where can they go?
Follow me on LinkedIn. I put my voice out there. Sometimes it's risky to write about my real lived experiences, but I also love to talk about what it's been like to be as a startup operator, as a financial planner, and in the founder seat. And I'm always looking to have conversations.
Great. And I'm sure people may reach out for how to build those 911 lists.
Absolutely.
Or who good startup coaches are. But what I can offer is a terrific UBS piece of research called Planning for Startup Founders. And if that's something that you want, please reach out to me directly at jill.lloyd, L-L-O-Y-D, at ubs.com. But in the meantime, I want to thank you again for joining me, Stephanie. It was a joy, and congratulations once again on a wonderful success.
Thank you, Jill. It was a pleasure to be here.
This podcast is presented for informational purposes only and should not be relied upon as investment advice or the basis for making any investment decisions. It does not constitute an offer to sell or a solicitation of an offer to buy any specific product or service. UBS does not provide legal or tax advice, and we would recommend listeners to obtain appropriate independent professional advice. Some of the views and opinions expressed may not be those of UBS Group AG or its affiliates. UBS Financial Services, Inc. offers investment advisory services in its capacity as an SEC-registered investment advisor and brokerage services in its capacity as an SEC-registered broker-dealer. These services are separate and distinct, differ in material ways, and are governed by different laws and separate arrangements. It is important that you understand the ways in which we conduct business and that you carefully read the agreements and disclosures that we provide about the products or services we offer. For more information, please review Client Relationship Summary, provided at ubs.com/relationship summary. UBS Financial Services, Inc. is a subsidiary of UBS Group AG and is a member of FINRA and SIPC.